This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Boomen. Central African Republic residents turned out in huge numbers for presidential and legislative elections on Sunday, the head of the UN mission said. This despite rebels opening fire in some areas to try to scare away voters. Rebel groups hostile to the incumbent president, who is seeking a second term, have carried out attacks and threatened to march to the Capitol and disrupt the election after the Constitutional Court this month rejected several candidates, including a popular former president. The current president is considered the favorite in the field of 17 candidates. Vote counting began on Sunday, and full provisional results are expected at week's end. Voters in Niger went to the polls Sunday in an election that is expected to lead to the West African nation's first transfer of power between two democratically elected presidents. A smooth handover could be a bright spot for a country blighted by widespread poverty and Islamist violence that has killed hundreds of civilians and soldiers this last year alone. Turkey's parliament passed a law Sunday that would ramp up oversight of foundations and associations and, according to rights groups including Amnesty International, risks limiting the freedoms of civil society organizations. The law allows the Interior Minister to replace members of organizations who are being investigated for terrorism charges, while the Interior Ministry can also apply to courts to halt the group's activities under the new law. Almost 10 months after the first Italian patient tested positive for the new coronavirus, Italy on Sunday vaccinated the first residents against COVID-19. Three health workers at a hospital in Rome were inoculated with the vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. This is VOA News. As the year end approaches, we take a look back now at some of the stories that made headlines this year. COVID in 2020. On January 11th, less than 2 weeks after it discovers a cluster of pneumonia cases of unknown cause, Beijing announces its first death from an illness which will become known as COVID-19. By March, a pandemic has been declared, and a month later, half of humanity is in lockdown as governments scramble to halt its spread. Massive state aid programs are rolled out to save jobs as the International Monetary Fund predicts recession, with the global economy shrinking by 4.4%. In November, drug companies announced positive results for several vaccines as a second wave of cases lashes the planet. Within a month, the first shots are being given, but by Christmas, some 1.7 million people are dead, with the U.S. being the worst hit. Belarus strongman President Alexander Lukashenko's disputed victory in August 9th elections sparks 4 months of anti-government protests centered on his main rival, political novice Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Opposition leaders are jailed or driven into exile. 2020 sees U.S.-China relations nosedive, with Trump calling COVID-19 the China virus and saying Beijing is responsible for a mass worldwide killing. They also clash over the repression of a Uyghur minority in the Chinese region of Xinjiang, as well as the national security law imposed on Hong Kong. In America, deeply divided Americans vote in record numbers in the November presidential election between outgoing Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden. After days of nail-biting, Biden takes the White House, Trump alleges fraud, and doesn't concede defeat. Heavy fighting for the Armenian-populated region of Nagorno-Karabakh, which broke away from Azerbaijan after a war in the 1990s, goes on for 45 days. Several thousand die before a Kremlin-brokered peace deal on November 9th, with Armenians losing swaths of territory to Azerbaijani forces. And Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed orders a military response to attacks on federal camps in the dissident northern Tigray region. The Tigray People's Liberation Front denies responsibility and says the reported attacks are a pretext for an invasion. Federal forces take the region's capital on November 28th. Via remote, Laurel Boomen, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2020. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The haunting specter of COVID-19 has been ever-present throughout the year. COVID-19 is the disease that's the result of being infected with the novel SARS coronavirus 2. The World Health Organization first declared COVID-19 to be a global pandemic on March 11th. According to Johns Hopkins University, the worldwide death toll from COVID-19 so far is well over 1.5 million people, with thousands of people dying each day from the disease. Our topic for the March 28th edition of Encounter was the U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic. My guests for the program were John Fortier, Director of Governance Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. According to a story published on March 20th in the Washington Post, U.S. intelligence agencies were issuing classified warnings about the coronavirus in January and definitely by February. The Trump administration was criticized for its slow and uneven response to the crisis. I asked John Fortier and Jim Kessler what mistakes they thought the administration made in addressing the pandemic and if there were any positive aspects of the U.S. response to the COVID-19 crisis.
Look, I think the president has done some things well and done some other things, you know, we could have done better. One thing that the president points to, and again, I think the country's divided about this, but the president points to him cutting off travel with China in a very early time, much earlier than Europe did. So that's something I think the president can point to. We also can point to the fact that the U.S. was slow on moving towards testing, and there were some false starts. I do think, though, that has come around in a way. Earlier would have been better in all circumstances, but the one thing I think the president has done fairly successfully has been marshaling the resources not only of the government and the state governments, but of the private sector. And the move towards lots more private sector work in the realm of testing has made the United States now, today, be a leader in testing. Again, all of this, I think the president will be judged as to how it goes as we go down the line. I think the president's too optimistic to say that he wants to have things opened up by Easter, although I don't think he said that as a definitive deadline. I think he's right to say that we are going to have to figure out how to have our economy and how to move back eventually. If he does so too rashly, I think that will be a big problem for the country and obviously for his fortunes. But that is something that we will have to wrestle with going forward. And clearly, the president does want the country to come together. Look, I think also governors have had significant leadership, governors on both sides. And, you know, interestingly, the president, I think, has had, aside from some side comments here and there, some actually decent relationships with the governors. And there is a sense that the Congress and the governors and the president are at least pushing in a direction that's helpful. But again, this is a terrible crisis, one that's only going to get worse. And, you know, we'll have to see at the end of the day how we judge the response.
Jim Kessler, turning to you for your take on the U.S. response to this coronavirus pandemic.
I think the president got off to a slow start on this, a very slow start. And this is one of those crises where time is not a friend. And that slow start, I think, is going to be lethal for people's physical health in this country. And it's going to be very damaging for the economy. He started when this crisis was gathering as being not a believer. He wasn't really taking it that seriously. He was very, very much downplaying it for far too long. Look, if he was a 19-year-old, he would have been one of the kids on the beach in Florida during spring break. And there are a lot of people in this country who, especially early on, did not think that this was going to be that serious. Since then, he has mostly come around, but we wasted valuable, valuable time. I want to give him credit and the administration credit on a few things. First of all, the Federal Reserve, which is independent, but the Federal Reserve has reacted aggressively to try and stabilize the financial sector and to inject money into the economy and to protect businesses, and did it at a faster pace and at higher levels of spending than even during the financial crisis of 2008. So the Fed deserves some high marks. The stimulus package that was negotiated by Speaker Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, and the White House, particularly Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. That is a good opening package that will help people. It's going to provide direct payments to tens of millions of Americans. It's boosting unemployment so that people will receive close to what they would normally get. It is going to hopefully keep businesses having folks on the payroll as much as possible and prevent the shuttering of small businesses and large businesses as well.
Widespread demonstrations broke out across the United States in late spring and early summer against police violence and racial injustice after George Floyd died in police custody on May 25th. Defund the police was a key slogan that reverberated among protesters. To talk about the state of policing in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, two distinguished analysts joined me via Skype for the June 14th edition of Encounter. One was Reggie Miller, president of the Nashville, Tennessee chapter of the National Black Police Association. The NBPA is a nationwide organization of African American police associations dedicated to the promotion of justice, fairness, and effectiveness in law enforcement. And Sam Fullwood III, a senior fellow for politics and elections at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal policy group based here in Washington. The protests encompassed a multiracial and ethnic coalition. So I asked my guests if the protests marked a turning point that could catalyze much needed police reform across America.
I think change is inevitable. I'm probably not quite as sanguine about it as Reggie and a whole lot of other people are. I'm not contradicting what he said at all. But I think because I have seen supposed movements for change burst into the scene, garner a great deal of attention, and then die down once the news items change the subject. And so I would like to see whether this is actually going to have the legs that a whole lot of progressive people would like for it to have. The reason I'm somewhat wary about being a little bit too euphoric at this being a really definitive moment is that the demands that people are making for change would have to work through a political system that is dysfunctional. And unless we figure out a way to make our politics work, the change may get stymied. It may be creating a latent form of anger only to erupt in another way going forward. One other thing I'd like to say about the change moment. One of the things that really struck me about what has happened in the past couple of weeks has been the universality of the anger and the outrage, which we haven't really seen in this country before. And that's giving lift to people thinking that that's going to happen, that change is on the precipice. But I think that we have been slowly building toward this moment because of demographic change that's taking place in the country. And I think this is kind of an eruption of the fact that the country is rapidly becoming less white male dominated and more diverse. And the people that you see in the streets over the past couple of weeks in all the major cities and around the world reflect the fact that the world is changing from being one where Western white maledom has been the dominant force of what's going on.
Reggie Miller, let's go back to policing in America. There has been accusations of systemic racism. How pervasive is racism in U.S. policing? What's your view?
I would definitely say that it's, in a lot of the cases, it's definitely more than just a few bad apples. Sometimes it is rotten to the core. And I think that is why people are talking about a total reform, totally breaking down the police department, trying to get it to reestablish itself on a totally different thought process that it has been for the last hundreds of years. And yes, I can speak to that personally because back in 1992, when I was working undercover, I got pulled over for an expired tag that the department had given me a vehicle to drive, and it had expired tags on it, which I didn't know. I got pulled over by some of the same guys that was in my roll call room that day. And from that, I got pulled over. There were five guys were on this traffic stop for an expired tag. And I got pulled out at gunpoint. I got, you know, choked. I got kneed in the back. I got my eyes gouged. I got kicked in the groin. And so I pursued this brutality. Of course, we were only about 10% Blacks on the police department. So now it became a separation of Blacks and whites because the Blacks supported it. You know, me standing up, me standing out, which I wasn't supposed to do because it's this thin blue line. You're supposed to take a couple of days off and they pat you on the back and just say, hey, you know, come back, man. We sorry. I wasn't letting that happen.
You're listening to the Best of Encounter 2020 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Here's a reminder that Encounter is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/encounter and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Now let's get back to our program featuring the highlights of Encounter in 2020. Shortly after the election in Belarus on August 9th, thousands of citizens peacefully took to the streets in the capital Minsk and elsewhere to protest, despite a violent crackdown by security forces. President and authoritarian strongman Alexander Lukashenko, who has been in power since 1994, shortly after the former Soviet Republic of Belarus gained its independence, falsely announced that he garnered 80% of the vote, defeating his rival Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was forced to flee the country for her and her children's safety. On the August 29th edition of Encounter, Stephen Nix, regional director of Eurasia at the International Republican Institute, and Laura Jewett, regional director of Eurasia programs at the National Democratic Institute, join me via Skype to discuss the prospects for meaningful democratic change in this longstanding authoritarian regime, which is closely allied with Russia. I asked my guests if they were surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted in Belarus after what was widely seen as a rigged election.
Well, I can't say we were surprised, because going into this particular election cycle, we sensed that there was a change electorate developing in Belarus. And we saw this by the attention and the emergence of some new players to the scene. First was Tikhanovsky, a blogger, Sepkala, Babariko, people who hadn't been associated with the democratic forces or the opposition political parties in Belarus. So these were relative newcomers who were drawing huge crowds, and all based on a platform of change for Belarus. And that was a message that resonated among these people. So we knew that this election might be different. And in terms of the protests, I think all of us will agree that we were amazed and astounded at the scope of these protests, the numbers, the passion that people are exhibiting. Belarusians finally are casting aside what we described as a fear society and are no longer afraid to speak up.
Laura Jewett, let me ask you the same question. To what extent you may have been surprised at the massive popular protests that erupted right after the election results were announced in Belarus?
It has been fascinating to watch. And I think the big takeaway for me is that these events have been a reminder to never discount the democratic aspirations of a population. There has long been an assumption about Belarusians that they had sort of grown accustomed to President Lukashenko and that they were a conservative and kind of risk-averse group, that they preferred stability over uncertainty. But as Steve says, both IRI and NDI have done research in Belarus, and we found starting really 5 years ago that there was this change electorate that he referred to that was emerging. These are people who were dissatisfied with the status quo and who were open to political change as a solution. And earlier this year, as the election approached, it became clear that this change electorate was growing and becoming more politicized and politically active than ever before. And we saw this during the election campaign. As Steve said, new faces came out as candidates. Citizens stood in hours-long lines to sign registration forms for opposition candidates, and they turned out in the tens of thousands for opposition campaign rallies. And then when Lukashenko, seeing this and understanding that he was losing support, blatantly rigged the election, and then through repression and violence, both before and during and after Election Day, this only added fuel to the momentum. And I think that the takeaway, again, as I say, is to never underestimate the degree to which people want to be treated with dignity and with justice and integrity. Because what started as a sort of a spontaneous movement in support of a democratic election has now become a real movement in support of democracy.
The topic for the September 13th edition of the program was the recent rapprochement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The United States brokered the deal known as the Abraham Accords between the UAE and Israel in return for a halt to Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. Joining me for this discussion via Skype where Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Hussein Ibish, a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. I asked both prominent experts for their take on this deal, its significance, and timing.
Short-term interests of the three parties appear to coincide with potentially transformative long-term implications. I mean, I think it's quite clear the timing in the case of two of them are driven in large part by electoral considerations, both with respect to Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu, although I suspect that however much hoopla and hype there is at this ceremony, it's not going to do Mr. Trump or Mr. Netanyahu much good politically. And in fact, it could actually hurt Netanyahu. It's not going to be good for his base. As far as MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, is concerned, I think it's a smart play. I tweeted out before, I think he, of the three, is the only one with a strategy, the only one who's not running for re-election, and the only one who is going to manage to really achieve a very concrete benefit out of this agreement, which is the delivery of F-35s, much more than a simple airplane. And while he had sought those aircraft for the last half dozen years or so, there's no doubt, even though the three may not want to admit it, that this was clearly a trade-off. So on balance, I think it's a win-win-win, although biggest win for MBZ. It's a lose for the Palestinians. Whether it is a transaction, as I've just described, or a transformation, as my friend Hussein Ibish knows, is going to depend on if and when others in the region decide to sign up. One additional point, I think it does reflect with a degree of empirical validity that I think Hussein and I would both agree on, that the region is changing. That under the cover of the Arab Peace Initiative, to which all the Arab states will continue to pay obeisance, each in their own way, at their own rate, their own time, a half dozen or so may well decide to negotiate separate and discrete arrangements, not discrete in the sense that they're private, but simply singular, separate relations with Israel.
Over to you, Hussein Ibish, for your take on the significance and the timing of the deal.
Well, I think it was a moment of opportunity where all three parties saw that they could get something they really wanted very quickly. The U.S. and Israel had gotten into a trap regarding annexation. The Trump Peace to Prosperity plan, which was issued in January, kind of invited Israel to annex large chunks of the West Bank. That would mean basically an end to the two-state solution, an end to the prospects for peace with the Palestinians under any recognizable circumstances, and it would have been very difficult. And I think Netanyahu kind of trumpeted for political reasons that he was going to do all of this, and then ran into the fact that this is a headache the Trump administration doesn't need right now. So I think Trump, having issued the plan and recognized Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem and Golan Heights, had done enough, and thinking about anything else as a second term issue at most. And Netanyahu needed to get out of it as well. Jordan was putting up a huge stink, and the United States, I think, was telling him, you know, really don't do this. And here comes MBZ, here comes the UAE with the proposition that they can begin the normalization process with Israel if they get a bunch of stuff they want, including the F-35s, including Reaper drones, including various other very high-tech American weaponry, which they have not been able to access. And they see Israel also as the natural partner, not only against Iran, but against Turkey and the Sunni Islamists, and as another sort of tech hub in the Middle East. UAE is very fixated on the idea of becoming a major tech commercial center. And they've gone pretty far in that regard. And when they look around the region, Israel seems the natural partner in that too. So on the one hand, he could do this. On the other hand, he could say to the rest of the Arabs, look, we're saving the two-state solution. We're saving the Arab Peace Initiative. We're saving the Palestinians from the threat of annexation. We're taking one for the team, which is a bit disingenuous, because what they're really doing is pursuing their national interests in a very focused way without really paying too much attention to other details.
At the urging of the outgoing Trump administration, several other Arab countries signed normalization agreements with the Jewish state before the end of 2020, including Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Along with the COVID-19 pandemic, the other key story this past year was the 2020 presidential and congressional elections. 1 month after former Vice President Joe Biden was declared the projected winner of the 2020 election, U.S. President Donald Trump continued efforts without success to overturn the results. Even though Democrats retained control of the House of Representatives, they did so with a slimmer margin. And by the end of the year, control of the Senate, the upper chamber, still hung in the balance, only to be determined by two runoff elections in the southern state of Georgia on January 5th, 2021. For now, Republicans hold 50 Senate seats, with Democrats holding 48. On the December 6th politics edition of our program, I discussed the Biden transition, President Trump's refusal to concede, and the Georgia runoff elections with our two veteran political analysts, John Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Even though Joe Biden garnered 306 electoral votes and gained 7 million more popular votes than Mr. Trump, the president refuses to recognize his loss. I asked Jim and John why they thought the president kept pushing to contest the election results in state legislatures, the courts, and the court of public opinion, and why so many Republican lawmakers remained silent rather than challenge him.
I think the election result is clear and isn't going to change. Joe Biden is going to be president on January 20th. All sorts of things you could point to on the Republican side that would be more positive than expected. Better results in the Congress, a better showing for President Trump. It was actually quite a close election in the Electoral College sense, similar to the 2016 election where then Donald Trump won three states by pretty close margins. This election came down to three states that Joe Biden won. Clearly, Joe Biden also had a bigger popular vote win. I think the early contention of the election was arguably warranted. We had a longer counting period and some issues that arose. But really, for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, I think the president's challenges, legal challenges and others really have been falling flat. And so I don't think there's anything that's going to change about that. And we're going to go forward. So again, there are people making arguments against what happened in the electoral process. Maybe there's some legitimate, and I think there are probably some legitimate questions about what we should do in the future and how we reform our election system. But I don't think there's any doubt. And so I think the president's efforts are really not going anywhere. And eventually, he said that when the Electoral College votes, and that's on December 14th, if there's a clearer result, he's going to accept that. I'm going to take him at his word at that. So I think maybe we'll have some resolution relatively soon. But again, I don't think the outcome is going to change, and Joe Biden will become president on January 20th.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, John Fortier makes a very good point that many of the down-ballot races were won by Republicans, contrary to what Democrats had wanted. But nonetheless, it's President Trump who continues to challenge the results. Why are so many Republican lawmakers not pushing him to accept these results? Because the attempts in the courts and challenging electoral officials in many of these key states has not been working.
So Donald Trump foreshadowed this at the Republican convention. He spent particularly the last day of the convention in his own speech talking about how this election is going to be stolen from him. And I think it was because of a belief by him and his advisors that there was no way he could win a free and fair election. I think they just felt they were not going to be able to win. So let's poison the water here as much as possible. And he is playing that up all the way through. I think what the president is doing right now, it's obviously wrong. I mean, virtually nobody who has an official Republican position believes that this election was fraudulent and that the election was stolen from him, except for a couple of crackpots. Unfortunately, President Trump is one of those crackpots, and I think this is doing some serious damage to the country and to our institutions that is going to be long-lasting. Nothing that Donald Trump is doing is surprising to me. What is surprising to me is the reticence of many Republican leaders to call him on it and say, enough is enough. And the truth of the matter is, they're still afraid of Donald Trump. They're afraid of him posting a negative tweet about him. My feeling is, if you're afraid of a negative tweet from Donald Trump, maybe you shouldn't be in office in the first place. Maybe you don't have the courage to be serving this country.
And that's Encounters Look Back at 2020. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks for listening today. And please join me again next week and next year for another encounter on The Voice of America.
to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners. So we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. She talks about how 2020 was difficult for teachers and students. Alice Bryant brings us a story about a baby elephant and the efforts to save it. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
At the beginning of 2020, the problems faced by American schools and colleges included issues like slavery, school shooting, sexual assault, and the use of technology. That all changed in March. The coronavirus pandemic sent students and teachers home, forcing schools in the U.S. and around the world to move classrooms online. Asha Choksi is head of research for Pearson Education. She saw the move to online learning as a chance to improve higher education. What it's done is, it's actually given a lot more power to students in terms of how, when, and where they learn, she said. However, Stephanie Hall of the policy research group, the Century Foundation, argued that online education can never really replace in-person learning in fields like healthcare and teaching. Hall said students need to experience what it is they're learning about, reading about, or hearing about in the classroom. And I don't know yet the degree to which technology can facilitate that. The health crisis also made it difficult for international students to stay in the United States. And it prevented U.S. students from studying in other countries. Brian Alexander is a professor at Georgetown University. He said the experience could push more colleges to develop online education. He warned, however, that might not happen if students have poor online experiences or if the coronavirus fades into being just another flu strain. As the year went on, it became clear that low-income communities and students in rural areas were not equipped for online education. Only half of the students in the city of Philadelphia had computers and home internet service. It took some time, but officials and businesses finally stepped in to provide equipment and service. In rural areas of South Carolina, without internet service, the state sent buses equipped with Wi-Fi internet to help. Students around the world faced similar problems. UNESCO reported in April that only half of the world's learners could take part in distance learning. In places like Bangladesh and Afghanistan, lack of electricity and internet service kept students from continuing their studies at home. Many countries, including Sri Lanka, Colombia, Ecuador, Chile, and Haiti, used radio and television broadcasts to provide education for at-home students. Diana Lopez is a teacher in Funza, a town near Bogota with 10,000 public school students. She said, "The radio lessons give children a space to develop their reading and writing skills and also show them that their teachers are still with them." Educators, however, worried about the mental health of students who could not attend school or see their friends. Frank Chen is a psychiatrist who has worked with college-age young adults. He said college can be a difficult experience for students with or without mental health issues as they balance work, studies, and personal relationships. A major event like the pandemic makes it very difficult to predict what the long-term psychological effects might be. I don't think that there's another event in the history of the people who are alive now that can really measure up to this, said Chen. In the state of Virginia, fifth grade teacher Aileen Watts said she and other teachers built in activities to help students reduce anxiety. Classes took brain breaks, which meant stopping the lesson to play a short game or even do a dance. And if a child was feeling anxious, he or she could partner with someone to help calm those emotions. In August, parents, teachers, and politicians debated on whether U.S. schools should reopen. Meanwhile, schools in countries where the pandemic was under more control, such as in Europe, South Korea, and Vietnam, were able to reopen successfully. As U.S. schools reopened, the tragic result was the death of teachers and infection of children with COVID-19. In the state of Mississippi, there were 604 cases among school teachers and workers by mid-September. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. She said, "If community spread is too high, as it is in Missouri and Mississippi, if you don't have the infrastructure of testing, and if you don't have the safeguards that prevent the spread of viruses in the schools, we believe that you cannot reopen in person." I'm Jill Robbins.
Now, here is Alice Bryant.
Mana Siriwat has performed many attempts to save lives in his 26 years as a rescue worker in Thailand. But he had never tried to do so for an elephant. That changed when Mana was called into action after a motorcycle hit a baby elephant. The small animal was crossing a road with a group of wild elephants in the eastern area of Chanthaburi. Mana began trying to save the animal as soon as he could. Someone nearby took a video, which quickly went viral on social media. During the rescue, Mana gave two-handed compressions to the small elephant, which was lying on its side. His co-workers treated the injured motorcycle rider a few meters away. Both the rider and elephant are recovering, and neither has serious injuries. "It's my instinct to save lives, but I was worried the whole time because I can hear the mother and other elephants calling for the baby," Mana told Reuters reporters over the phone. Mana has dealt with several road traffic accidents involving humans. The elephant was the only victim he has been able to save while performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. When the baby elephant starting to move, I almost cried, he said. To help the baby elephant live, Mana had to estimate where an elephant's heart would be. He did so based on where the human heart sits in the body and based on a video he had seen online. The young animal stood up after about 10 minutes and was taken to another area for treatment. Workers then brought the elephant back to the place of the accident in the hope of reuniting it with its mother. The group of elephants returned, Mana said, when the mother heard her baby calling out. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Every word has its own story. Where did it come from? How did it get into the language? Today's word is Shenandoah. Hundreds of years ago, a Native American chief named Shenandoah lived with his tribes in what is now the state of Virginia. Little is known about Shenandoah, but in some way, the soft sound of his name was given to a river. The Shenandoah River still flows in a deep valley between the Allegheny and Blue Ridge Mountains, just as it did when Chief Shenandoah lived. It is a slow-moving river, soft and as beautiful as its name. There are some word experts who believe the word Shenandoah means spruce river, because the waters of the river run through great forests of spruce trees. And this explanation could be correct. However, there is an old Native American story which is far more beautiful than that of the experts. Long ago, centuries before Europeans came to the New World, there was a great lake of sparkling blue water hidden in the mountains of Virginia. This lake was 250 kilometers long and 50 kilometers wide. For hundreds of years, Native American tribes lived near this lake, feeding on the fish from its clean waters. The Native Americans often climbed up the mountains and camped there during their long hunts for food. In the evenings, they sat near their camp and looked down at the beautiful lake. On a clear, starry night, you could see thousands of stars shining and dancing on the water below. The Native Americans loved this lake, and because they could see the stars in it, they called the lake Clear Daughter of the Stars. In their language, the word for this was Shenandoah. One day, there was a loud crashing sound at one end of the lake. The lake started to disappear. Its water ran out of the valley through a break in the mountainside. The waters ran on and on until they joined another river, which today is known as the Potomac. At last, the lake was gone. In its place was only a river. It is this way today. The lake is gone, but the beautiful Shenandoah River runs on. And on a clear night, anyone in the mountains can still see the stars dancing on the water. Shenandoah National Park has just over 80,000 hectares of protected lands. The park has cascading waterfalls, beautiful mountain vistas,
and Serene Woods. Located outside of Washington, D.C., the Shenandoah National Park is a popular getaway for people wanting to hike, picnic, or nature watch. Millions of Americans have seen the Shenandoah and have talked about it. And some years ago, someone wrote a song about it. Shenandoah is perhaps one of America's most recognizable folk songs. Some say the song refers to the river. Others say it is about the daughter of Chief Shenandoah. Regardless of what the song is about, Shenandoah remains an American classic. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation. But administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, the smell of their bodies will force Congress to act. Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay, yet Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them. And no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.